Behind him is the standoffish, ruddy-faced woman from upstairs. She glares impatiently at Parry. Julien calls her La Chèvre because of her goat-like nest of chin hairs. He says, "Let's go, Parry. We're already late." He has made reservations for 7 o'clock at a new restaurant in the 16th arrondissement that has been making some noise for its poulet braisé, its sole cardinal, and its calf's liver with sherry vinegar. They are meeting Christiane and Orly, old university friends of Julien's, from his student days, not his teaching. They're supposed to meet for aperitifs at 6:30, and it is already 6:15. They still have to walk to the metro station, right to Muet, then walk the 6 blocks to the restaurant. The phone keeps on ringing. The goat woman coughs. Julien says, more firmly now, "Parry." "It's probably Maman," Parry says. "Yes, I'm aware of that." Irrationally, Parry thinks Maman, with her endless flair for drama, has chosen this specific moment to call to trap her into making precisely this choice. Step into the elevator with Julien or take her car. "It could be important," she says. Julien sighs. As the elevator doors close behind him, he leans against the hallway wall. He digs his hands deep into the pockets of his trench coat, looking for a moment like a character from a Melville policier. "I'll only be a minute," Parry says. Julien casts a skeptical glance. Julien's apartment is small. 6 quick steps and she has crossed the foyer, past the kitchen, and is seated on the edge of the bed, reaching for the phone on the lone nightstand for which they have room. The view, however, is spectacular. It's raining now, but on a clear day she can look out the east-facing window and see most of the 19th and 20th arrondissements. "Oui, hello," she says into the receiver. A man's voice answers. "Bonsoir. Is this Mademoiselle Parry Vatatie?" "Who is calling?" "Are you the daughter of Madame Nila Vatatie?" "Yes." "My name is Dr. Delaunay. I am calling about your mother." Parry shuts her eyes. There is a brief flash of guilt before it is overtaken by a customary dread. She has taken calls of this sort before, too many to count now, from the time she was an adolescent, really, and even before that. Once in 5th grade, she was in the middle of a geography exam, and the teacher had to interrupt, walk her out to the hallway, and explain in a hushed voice what had happened. These calls are familiar to Parry, but repetition has not led to insouciance on her part. With each one, she thinks, this time, this is the time. And each time, she hangs up and rushes to Maman. In the parlance of economics, Julien has said to Parry that if she cuts off the supply of attention, perhaps the demand for it would cease as well. "She's had an accident," Dr. Delaunay says. Parry stands by the window and listens as the doctor explains. She coils and uncoils the phone cord around her finger as he recounts her mother's hospital visit, the forehead laceration, the sutures, the precautionary tetanus injection, the aftercare of peroxide, topical antibiotics, dressings. Parry's mind flashes to when she was 10, when she'd come home one day from school and found 25 francs and a handwritten note on the kitchen table. "I've gone to Alsace with Mark. You remember him. Back in a couple of days. Be a good girl. Don't stay up late. Je t'aime, Mama." Parry had stood, shaking in the kitchen, eyes filling up, telling herself 2 days wasn't so bad. It wasn't so long. The doctor is asking her a question. "Pardon? I was saying, will you be coming to take her home, mademoiselle? The injury is not serious, you understand. But it's probably best that she not go home alone. Or else we could call her a taxi." "No, no need. I should be there in 30 minutes. She sits on the bed. Julien will be annoyed, probably embarrassed as well in front of Christiane and Orly, whose opinions seem to matter a great deal to him. Parry doesn't want to go out in the hallway and face Julien. She doesn't want to go to Courbevoie and face her mother either. What she would rather do is lie down, listen to the wind hurl pellets of rain at the glass until she falls asleep. She lights a cigarette, and when Julian enters the room behind her and says, "You're not coming, are you?" she doesn't answer. Excerpt from Afghan Songbird, an interview with Nila Vahdati by Etienne Boustolet, Parallax 84, Winter 1974, page 33. "So I understand you are in fact half Afghan, half French?" "My mother was French, yes. She was a Parisian. But she met your father in Kabul. You were born there." "Yes, they met there in 1927, at a formal dinner in the Royal Palace. My mother had accompanied her father, my grandfather, who had been sent to Kabul to counsel King Amanullah on his reforms. Are you familiar with him, King Amanullah?" We are sitting in the living room of Nila Vahdati's small apartment on the 30th floor of a residential building in the town of Courbevoie, just northwest of Paris. The room is small, not well lit, and is sparsely decorated. A saffron upholstered couch, a coffee table, two tall bookshelves. She sits with her back to the window, which she has opened to air the smoke from the cigarettes she lights continually. Nila Vahdati states her age as 44. She is a strikingly attractive woman, perhaps past the peak of her beauty, but as yet not far past. High royal cheekbones, good skin, slim waist. She has intelligent, flirtatious eyes, and a penetrating gaze under which one feels simultaneously appraised, tested, charmed, toyed with. They remain, I suspect, a redoubtable seduction tool. She wears no makeup save for lipstick, a smudge of which has strayed a bit from the outline of her mouth. She wears a bandana over her brow, a faded purple blouse over jeans, no socks, no shoes. Though it is only 11 in the morning, she pours from a bottle of Chardonnay that has not been chilled. She has genially offered me a glass, and I have declined. "He was the best king they ever had." I find the remark of interest for its choice of pronoun. "They? You don't consider yourself Afghan? Let's say I've divorced myself from my more troublesome half." I'm curious as to why that is. "If he had succeeded, meaning King Amanullah, I might have answered your question differently." I ask her to explain. "You see, he woke one morning, the king, and proclaimed his plan to reshape the country, kicking and screaming, if need be, into a new and more enlightened nation. 'By God,' he said, 'no more wearing of the veil for one.' Imagine, Monsieur Boussoulet, a woman in Afghanistan arrested for wearing a burqa. When his wife, Queen Soraya, appeared barefaced in the public, ooh la la, the lungs of the mullahs inflated with enough gasps to fly 1,000 Hindenburgs. 'And no more polygamy,' he said. This, you understand, in a country where kings had legions of concubines and never set eyes on most of the children that so frivolously fathered. 'From now on,' he declared, 'no man can force you into marriage. And no more bride price, brave women of Afghanistan, and no more child marriage. And here is more. You will all attend school.' He was a visionary then. Or a fool. I've always found the line perilously thin myself. What happened to him?" The answer is as vexing as it's predictable, Monsieur Boussoulet. Jihad, of course. They declared jihad on him, the mullahs, the tribal chiefs. Picture 1,000 fists shot heavenward. The king had made the earth move, you see? But he was surrounded by an ocean of zealots. And you know well what happens when the ocean floor trembles, Monsieur Boussoulet. A tsunami of bearded rebellion crashed down upon the poor king and carried him off, flailing helplessly, and spat him out on the shores of India, then Italy, and at last Switzerland, where he crawled from the muck and died a disillusioned old man in exile. And the country that emerged, I gather it did not suit you well. The reverse is equally true, which was why you moved to France in 1955. I moved to France because I wished to save my daughter from a certain kind of life. What kind of life would that be? I didn't want her turned against both her will and nature, into one of those diligent, sad women who are bent on a lifelong course of quiet servitude, forever in fear of showing, saying, or doing the wrong thing. Women who are admired by some in the West, here in France, for instance, turned into heroines for their hard lives, admired from a distance by those who couldn't bear even one day of walking in their shoes. Women who see their desires doused and their dreams renounced. And yet, and this is the worst of it, Monsieur Beausoleil, if you meet them, they smile and pretend they have no misgiving at all, as though they lead enviable lives. But you look closely and you see the helpless look, the desperation, and how it belies all the show of good humor. It is quite pathetic, Monsieur Beausoleil. I did not want this for my daughter. I gather she understands all this. She lights another cigarette. Well, children are never everything you'd hoped for, Monsieur Beausoleil. In the emergency room, Parry is instructed by an ill-tempered nurse to wait by the registration desk, near a wheeled rack filled with clipboards and charts. It astonishes Parry that there are people who voluntarily spend their youth training for a profession that lands them in a place such as this. She cannot begin to understand it. She loathes hospitals. She hates seeing people at their worst. The sickly smell, the squeaky gurneys, the hallways with their drab paintings, the insistent paging overhead. Dr. Delaunay turns out younger than Parry had expected. He has a slender nose, a narrow mouth, and tight blonde curls. He guides her out of the emergency room, through the swinging double doors, into the main hallway. When your mother arrived, he says in a confidential tone, she was quite inebriated. You don't seem surprised. I am not. Neither were a number of the nursing staff. They say she runs a bit of a tab here. I'm new here myself, so, of course, I've never had the pleasure. How bad was it? She was quite ordinary, he says, and I should say rather theatrical. They share a brief grin. Will she be all right? Yes, in the short term, Dr. Delaunay says. But I must recommend, and quite emphatically, that she reduce her drinking. She was lucky this time, but who's to say next time? Parry nods. Where is she? He leads her back into the emergency room and around the corner. Bed 3. I'll be by shortly with discharge instructions. Parry thanks him and makes her way to her mother's bed. Salut, maman. Maman smiles, tiredly. Her hair is disheveled, and her socks don't match. They have wrapped her forehead with bandages, and a colorless fluid drips through an intravenous link to her left arm. She's wearing a hospital gown the wrong way and has not tied it properly. The gown has parted slightly in the front, and Parry can see a little of the thick, dark, vertical line of her mother's old caesarean scar. She had asked her mother a few years earlier why she didn't bear the customary horizontal mark, and Maman explained that the doctors had given her some sort of technical reason at the time that she no longer remembered. The important thing, she said, was that they got you out. I've ruined your evening, Maman mutters. Accidents happen. I've come to take you home. I could sleep a week. Her eyes drift shut, though she keeps talking in a sluggish, stalling manner. I was just sitting and watching TV. I got hungry. I went to the kitchen to get some bread and marmalade. I slipped. I'm not sure how or on what, but my head caught the oven door handle on the way down. I think I might have blocked out for a minute or two. Sit down, Parry. You're looming over me. Parry sits. The doctor said you were drinking. Maman cracks an eye half open. Her frequenting of doctors is exceeded only by her dislike of them. That boy, he said that? Le petit salut. What does he know? His breath still smells of his mother's tit. You always joke, every time I bring it up. I am tired, Parry. You can scold me another time. the whipping post isn't going anywhere. Now she does fall asleep, snores, unattractively, as she does only after a binge. Paris sits on the bedside stool, waiting for Dr. Delaunay, picturing Julien at a low-lit table, menu in hand, explaining the crisis to Christiane and Orly over tall goblets of Bordeaux. He offered to accompany her to the hospital, but in a perfunctory way. It was a mere formality. Coming here would have been a bad idea anyway. If Dr. Delaunay thought he had seen theatrical earlier, still, if he couldn't come with her, Parry wishes he hadn't gone to dinner without her either. She's still a little astonished that he did. He could have explained it to Christiane and Orly. They could have picked another night, changed the reservations. But Julien had gone. It wasn't merely thoughtless. No, there was something vicious about this move. Deliberate, slashing. Parry has known for some time that he has that capacity. She has wondered of late whether he has a taste for it as well. It was in an emergency room, not unlike this one, that Maman first met Julien. That was 10 years ago, in 1963, when Parry was 14. He had driven a colleague who had a migraine. Maman had brought Parry, who was the patient that time, having sprained her ankle badly during gymnastics in school. Parry was lying on a gurney when Julien pushed his chair into the room and struck up a conversation with Maman. Parry cannot remember now what was said between them. She does remember Julien saying, "Paris, like the city," and from Maman, the familiar reply, "No, without the S, it means fairy in Farsi." They met him for dinner on a rainy night later that week at a small bistro off Boulevard Saint-Germain. Back at the apartment, Maman had made a protracted show of indecision over what to wear, settling in the end for a pastel blue dress with a close-fitting waist, evening gloves and sharp-pointed stiletto shoes. And even then, in the elevator, she had said to Parry, "It's not too Jackie, is it? What do you think?" Before the meal, they smoked, all three of them, and Maman and Julien had beer in oversized frosted mugs. They finished one round. Julien ordered a second, and there was a third as well. Julien in white shirt, tie, and a checkered evening blazer, had the controlled, courteous manners of a well-bred man. He smiled with ease and laughed effortlessly. He had just a pinch of grey at the temples, which Parry hadn't noticed in the dim light of the emergency room, and she estimated his age around the same as Maman's. He was well-versed in current events and spent some time talking about de Gaulle's veto of England's entry into the common market, and to Parry's surprise, almost succeeded in making it interesting. Only after Maman asked did he reveal that he had started teaching economics at the Sorbonne. "A professor? Very glamorous." "Oh, hardly," he said. "You should sit in sometime. It would cure you of that notion swiftly." "Maybe I will." Parry could tell Maman was already a little drunk. "Maybe I will sneak in one day. Watch you in action." "Action? You do recall I teach economic theory, Nila. If you do come, what you will find is that my students think I'm a twit." "Well, I doubt that." Parry did too. She guessed that a good many of Julian's students wanted to sleep with him. Throughout dinner, she was careful not to get caught looking at him. He had a face right out of film noir, a face meant to be shot in black and white, parallel shadows of Venetian blinds slashing across it, a plume of cigarette smoke spiraling beside it. A parenthesis-shaped piece of hair managed to fall on his brow, ever so gracefully, too gracefully, perhaps. If, in fact, it was dangling there without calculation, Parry noticed that he never bothered to fix it. He asked Maman about the small bookshop she owned and ran. It was across the Seine, on the other side of Pont d'Arcole. "Do you have books on jazz?" "Bah oui," Maman said. The rain outside rose in pitch, and the bistro grew more boisterous. As the waiter served them cheese puffs and ham brochettes, There followed, between Maman and Julian, a lengthy discussion of Bud Powell, Sonia Stitt, Dizzy Gillespie, and Julian's favorite, Charlie Parker. Maman told Julian she liked more the West Coast styles of Chet Baker and Miles Davis. Had he listened to Kind of Blue? Perry was surprised to learn that Maman liked jazz this much, and that she was so conversant about so many different musicians. She was struck, not for the first time, by both a childlike admiration for Maman and an unsettling sense that she did not really fully know her own mother. What did not surprise was Maman's effortless and thorough seduction of Julian. Maman was in her element there. She never had trouble commanding men's attention. She engulfed men. Perry watched Maman as she murmured playfully, giggled at Julian's jokes, tilted her head, and absently twirled a lock of her hair. She marveled again at how young and beautiful Maman was. Maman, who was only 20 years older than herself. Her long dark hair, her full chest, her startling eyes, and a face that glowed with the intimidating sheen of classic regal features. Perry marveled further at how little resemblance she herself bore to Maman, with her solemn pale eyes, her long nose, her gap-toothed smile, and her small breasts. If she had any beauty, it was of a more modest, earthbound sort. Being around her mother always reminded Perry that her own looks were woven of common cloth. At times it was Maman herself who did the reminding, though it always came hidden in a Trojan horse of compliments. She would say, "You're lucky, Perry. You won't have to work as hard for men to take you seriously. They'll pay attention to you. Too much beauty. It corrupts things." She would laugh. "Oh, listen to me. I'm not saying I speak from experience. Of course not. It's merely an observation. You're saying I'm not beautiful? I'm saying you don't want to be. Besides, you're pretty, and that is plenty good enough. Je t'assure, ma chérie. It's better even." She didn't resemble her father much either, Perry believed. He had been a tall man with a serious face, a high forehead, narrow chin, and thin lips. Perry kept a few pictures of him in her room from her childhood in the Kabul house. He had fallen ill in 1955, which was when Maman and she had moved to Paris, and had died shortly after. Sometimes Perry found herself gazing at one of his old photos, particularly a black and white of the two of them, she and her father, standing before an old American car. He was leaning against the fender, and she was in his arms, both of them smiling. She remembered she had sat with him once as he painted giraffes and long-tailed monkeys for her on the side of an armoire. He had let her color one of the monkeys, holding her hand, patiently guiding her brush strokes. Seeing her father's face in those photos stirred an old sensation in Perry, a feeling that she had had for as long as she could remember, that there was in her life the absence of something, or someone, fundamental to her own existence. Sometimes it was vague, like a message sent across shadowy byways and vast distances. A weak signal on a radio dial, remote, warbled. Other times it felt so clear, this absence, so intimately close it made her heart lurch. For instance, in Provence, 2 years earlier, when Perry had seen a massive oak tree outside a farmhouse. Another time, at the Jardin des Tuileries, when she had watched a young mother pull her son in a little red radio flyer wagon. Perry didn't understand. She read a story once about a middle-aged Turkish man who had suddenly slipped into a deep depression when the twin brother he never knew existed had suffered a fatal heart attack while on a canoe excursion in the Amazon rainforest. It was the closest anyone had ever come to articulating what she felt. She had once spoken to Maman about it. "Well, it's hardly a mystery, mon amour," Maman had said. "You miss your father. He's gone from your life. It's natural that you should feel this way. Of course, that's what it is. Come here. Give Momo a kiss. Her mother's answer had been perfectly reasonable, but also unsatisfactory. Parry did believe that she would feel more whole if her father was still living, if he were here with her. But she also remembered feeling this way even as a child, living with both her parents at the big house in Kabul. Shortly after they finished their meal, Maman excused herself to go to the bistro's bathroom, and Parry was alone a few minutes with Julien. They talked about a film Parry had seen the week before, one with Jean Moreau playing a gambler, and they talked about school and music too. When she spoke, he rested his elbows on the table and leaned in a bit toward her, listening with great interest, both smiling and frowning, never lifting his eyes from her. It's a show, Parry told herself. He's only pretending. A polished act, something he trotted out for women, something he had chosen to do now on the spur of the moment, to toy with her a while and amuse himself at her expense. And yet, under his unrelenting gaze, she could not help her pulse quickening and her belly tightening. She found herself speaking in an artificially sophisticated, ridiculous tone that was nothing like the way she spoke normally. She knew she was doing it and couldn't stop. He told her he'd been married once, briefly. Really? A few years back, when I was 30, I lived in Lyon at the time. He had married an older woman. It had not lasted because she had been very possessive of him. Julien had not disclosed this earlier when Maman was still at the table. It was a physical relationship, really, he said. C'était complètement sexuel. She wanted to own me. He was looking at her when he said this and smiling a subversive little smile, cautiously gauging her reaction. Parry lit a cigarette and played it cool, like Bardot. Like this was the sort of thing men told her all the time. But inside, she was trembling. She knew that a small act of betrayal had been committed at the table. Something a little illicit. Not entirely harmless, but undeniably thrilling. When Maman returned, with her hair brushed anew and a fresh coat of lipstick, their stealthy moment broke. And Parry briefly resented Maman for intruding, for which she was immediately overcome with remorse. She saw him again a week or so later. It was morning, and she was going into Maman's room with a bowl of coffee. She found him sitting on the side of Maman's bed, winding his wristwatch. She hadn't known he had spent the night. She spotted him from the hallway, through a crack in the door. She stood there, rooted to the ground, bowl in hand, her mouth feeling like she had sucked a dry clump of mud. And she watched him, the spotless skin of his back, the small pouch of his belly, the darkness between his legs partly shrouded by the rumpled sheets. He clasped on his watch, reached for a cigarette off the nightstand, lit it, and then casually swung his gaze to her, as if he had known she was there all along. He gave her a close-mouthed smile. Then Maman said something from the shower, and Parry wheeled around. It was a marvel she didn't scald herself with the coffee. Maman and Julien were lovers for about 6 months. They went to the cinema a lot, and to museums, and small art galleries featuring the works of struggling obscure painters with foreign names. One weekend, they drove to the beach in Arcachon, near Bordeaux, and returned with tanned faces and a case of red wine. Julien took her to faculty events at the university, and Maman invited him to author readings at the bookstore. Parry tagged along at first. Julien asked her to, which seemed to please Maman. But soon she started making excuses to stay home. She wouldn't go, couldn't. It was unbearable. She was too tired, she said, or else she didn't feel well. She was going to her friend Colette's house to study, she said. Her friend since second grade. Colette was a wiry, brittle-looking girl with a long, limp hair and a nose like a crow's beak. She liked to shock people and say outrageous, scandalous things. I'll bet he's disappointed, Colette said, that you don't go out with them. Well, if he is, he's not letting on. He wouldn't let on, would he? What would your mother think? About what? Parry said, though she knew, of course. She knew, and what she wanted was to hear it said. About what? Colette's tone was sly, excited. That he's with her to get to you. That it's you he wants. That's disgusting, Parry said with a flutter. Or maybe he wants you both. Maybe he likes a crowd in bed. In which case, I might ask you to put in a good word for me. You're repulsive, Colette. Sometimes, when Maman and Julien were out, Parry would undress in the hallway and look at herself in the long mirror. She would find faults with her body. It was too tall, she would think, too unshapely, too utilitarian. She had inherited none of her mother's bewitching curves. Sometimes she walked like this, undressed, to her mother's room and lay on the bed where she knew Maman and Julien made love. Parry lay there, stark naked, with her eyes closed, heart battering, basking in heedlessness. Something like a hum spreading across her chest, her belly, and lower still. It ended, of course. They ended, Maman and Julien. Parry was relieved, but not surprised. Men always failed Maman in the end. They forever fell disastrously short of whatever ideal she held them up to. What began with exuberance and passion always ended with terse accusations and hateful words, with rage and weeping fits, and the flinging of cooking utensils and collapse. High drama. Maman was incapable of either starting or ending a relationship without excess. Then the predictable period when Maman would find a sudden taste for solitude. She would stay in bed, wearing an old winter coat over her pajamas, a weary, doleful, unsmiling presence in the apartment. Parry knew to leave her alone. Her attempts at consoling and companionship were not welcome. It lasted weeks, the sullen mood. With Julien, it went on considerably longer. Oh, merde, Maman says now. She's sitting up in bed, still in the hospital gown. Dr. Delaunay has given Parry the discharge papers, and the nurse is unhooking the intravenous from Maman's arm. What is it? I just remembered. I have an interview in a couple of days. An interview? A feature for a poetry magazine. That's fantastic, Maman. They're accompanying the piece with a photo. She points to the sutures on her forehead. I'm sure you'll find some elegant way to hide it, Parry says. Maman sighs, looks away. When the nurse yanks the needle out, Maman winces and barks at the woman something unkind and undeserved. From Afghan Songbird, an interview with Nila Vahdati by Etienne Boustolet. Parallax, 84, Winter, 1974, page 36. I look around the apartment again, and I'm drawn to a framed photograph on one of the bookshelves. It is of a little girl, squatting in a field of wild bushes, fully absorbed in the act of picking something, some sort of berry. She wears a bright yellow coat, buttoned to the throat, which contrasts with the dark grey overcast sky above. In the background, there is a stone farmhouse with closed shutters and battered shingles. I ask about the picture. My daughter, Parry, like the city, but no S. It means fairy. That picture is from a trip to Normandy we took, the two of us, back in 1957, I think. She must have been 8. Does she live in Paris? She studies mathematics at the Sorbonne. You must be proud. She smiles and shrugs. I'm struck a bit by her choice of career, given that you devoted yourself to the arts. I don't know where she gets the ability, all those incomprehensible formulas and theories. I guess they're not incomprehensible to her. I can hardly multiply myself. Perhaps it is her way of rebelling. You know a thing or two about rebellion, I think. Yes, but I did it the proper way. I drank and smoked and took lovers. Who rebels with mathematics? She laughs. Besides, she would be the proverbial rebel without a cause. I've given her every freedom imaginable. She wants for nothing, my daughter. She lacks nothing. She's living with someone, is quite a bit older, charming to a fault, well-read, entertaining. A raging narcissist, of course. Ego the size of Poland. You don't approve? Whether I approve or not is irrelevant. This is France, Monsieur Boussoulet, not Afghanistan. Young people don't live or die by the stamp of parental approval. Your daughter has no ties to Afghanistan, then? We left when she was 6. She has limited memory of her time there. But not you, of course. I ask her to tell me about her early life. She excuses herself and leaves the room for a moment. When she returns, she hands me an old, wrinkled, black-and-white photograph. A stern-looking man, heavy-set, bespectacled, hair shiny, and combed with an impeccable part. He sits behind a desk, reading a book. He wears a suit with peaked lapels, double-breasted vest, high-collared white shirt, and bow tie. My father, 1929, the year I was born. He looks quite distinguished. He was part of the Pashtun aristocracy in Kabul. Highly educated, unimpeachable manners, appropriately sociable. A great raconteur, too, at least in public. And in private? Venture to guess, Monsieur Boussoulet. I pick up the photo and look at it again. Distant, I would say. Grave. Inscrutable. Uncompromising. I really insist you have a glass with me. I loathe drinking alone. She pours me a glass of the Chardonnay. Out of politeness, I take a sip. He had cold hands, my father, no matter the weather. His hands were always cold. And he always wore a suit, again, no matter the weather. Perfectly tailored, sharp creases. A fedora, too. And wingtips, of course, two-toned. He was handsome, I suppose. Though in a solemn way. Also, and I understand this only much later, in a manufactured, slightly ridiculous, for European way. Complete, of course, with weekly games of lawn, bowling, and polo, and the coveted French wife. All of it to the great approval of the young progressive king. She picks at her nail and doesn't say anything for a while. I flip the tape in my recorder. My father slept in his own room, my mother and I in ours. Most days he was out having lunch with ministers and advisers to the king, or else he was out riding horses or playing polo or hunting. He loved to hunt. So you didn't see much of him. He was an absentee figure. Not entirely. He made it a point every couple of days to spend a few minutes with me. He would come into my room and sit on my bed, which was my signal to climb into his lap. He would bounce me on his knees for a while, neither one of us saying much, and finally he would say, "Well, what shall we do now, Nila?" Sometimes he would let me take the handkerchief from his breast pocket and let me fold it. Of course, I would just ball it up and stuff it back into his pocket, and he would feign an expression of mock surprise, which I found highly comical, and we'd keep doing this until he tired of it, which was soon enough. And then he would stroke my hair with his cold hands and say, "Papa has to go now, my fawn. Run along." She takes the photograph back to the other room and returns, fetches a new pack of cigarettes from a drawer, and lights one. That was his nickname for me. I loved it. I used to hop around the garden. We had a very large garden, chanting. I am Papa's fawn. I am Papa's fawn. It wasn't until much later that I saw how sinister the nickname was. I'm sorry, she smiles. My father shot deer, Monsieur Beausoleil. They could have walked a few blocks to Maman's apartment, but the rain has just picked up considerably. In the taxi, Maman sits balled up in the back seat, draped by Parry's raincoat, wordlessly staring out the window. She looks old to Parry at this instant, far older than her 44 years, old and fragile and thin. Parry has not been to Maman's apartment in a while. When she turns the key and lets them in, she finds the kitchen counter cluttered with dirty wine glasses, open bags of chips and uncooked pasta, plates with clumps of unrecognizable food fossilized onto them. A paper bag stuffed with empty wine bottles sits on the table, precariously close to tipping over. Parry sees newspapers on the floor, one of them soaking up the blood spill from earlier in the day, and on it a single pink wool sock. It frightens Parry to see Maman's living space in this state, and she feels guilt as well, which, knowing Maman, may have been the intended effect. And then she hates that she had this last thought. It's a sort of thing Julian would think. She wants you to feel badly. He has said this to her several times over the last year. She wants you to feel badly. When he first said it, Parry felt relieved, understood. She was grateful to him for articulating what she could not, or would not. She thought she had found an ally. But these days, she wonders. She catches in his words a glint of meanness, a troubling absence of kindness. The bedroom floor is littered with pieces of clothing, records, books, more newspapers. On the windowsill is a glass half-filled with water, gone yellow from the cigarette butts floating in it. She swipes books and old magazines off the bed and helps Mama slip beneath the blankets. Mama looks up at her, the back of one hand resting on her bandaged brow. The pose makes her look like an actress in a silent film about to faint. Are you going to be all right, Mama? I don't think so, she says. It doesn't come out like a plea for attention. Maman says this in a flat, bored voice. It sounds tired and sincere and final. You're scaring me, Maman. Are you leaving now? Do you want me to stay? Yes. Then I'll stay. Turn off the light. Maman? Yes. Are you taking your pills? Have you stopped? I think you've stopped. And I worry. Don't start in on me. Turn off the light. Parry does. She sits on the edge of the bed and watches her mother fall asleep. Then she heads for the kitchen to begin the formidable task of cleaning up. She finds a pair of gloves and starts with the dishes. She washes glasses reeking of long soured milk, bowls crusted with old cereal, plates with food spotted with green fuzzy patches of fungus. She recalls the first time she had washed dishes at Julian's apartment, the morning after they had slept together for the first time. Julian had made them omelets. How she'd relished this simple domestic act, washing plate at his sink, as he played a Jane Birkin song on the turntable. She had reconnected with him the year before in 1973, for the first time in almost a decade. She had run into him at a street march outside the Canadian embassy, a student protest against the hunting of seals. Parry didn't want to go, and also she had a paper on meromorphic functions that needed finishing. But Colette insisted. They were living together at the time, an arrangement that was increasingly proving to their mutual displeasure. Colette smoked grass now. She wore headbands and loose magenta-colored tunics, embroidered with birds and daisies. She brought home long-haired, unkempt boys who ate Parry's food and played the guitar badly. Colette was always in the streets, shouting, denouncing cruelty to animals, racism, slavery, French nuclear testing in the Pacific. There was always an urgent buzz around the apartment. People Perry didn't know milling in and out, and when they were alone, Perry sensed a new tension between the two of them, a haughtiness on the part of Colette, an unspoken disapproval of her. "They're lying," Colette said animatedly. "They say their methods are humane. Humane? Have you seen what they use to club them over the head? Those hackapits. Half the time, the poor animal hasn't even died yet, and the bastards stick their hooks in it and drag it out to the boat. They skin them alive, Perry, alive!" The way Colette said this last thing, the way she emphasized it, made Perry want to apologize. For what, she was not quite sure, but she knew that these days it squeezed the breath out of her being around Colette and her reproaches and many outrages. Only about 30 people showed up. There was a rumor that Brigitte Bardot was going to make an appearance, but it turned out to be just that, only a rumor. Colette was disappointed at the turnout. She had an agitated argument with a thin, pale, bespectacled young man named Eric, who, Perry gathered, had been in charge of organizing the march. Poor Eric, Perry pitied him. Still seething, Colette took the lead. Perry shuffled along toward the back, next to a flat-chested girl who shouted slogans with a kind of nervous exhilaration. Perry kept her eyes to the pavement and tried her best to not stand out. At the street corner, a man tapped her on the shoulder. "You look like you're dying to be rescued." He was wearing a tweed jacket over a sweater, jeans, a wool scarf. His hair was longer, and he had aged some, but elegantly in a way that some women his age might find unfair and even infuriating. Still lean and fit, a couple of crow's feet, some more graying at the temples, his face set with just a light touch of weariness. "I am," she said. They kissed on the cheek, and when he asked if she would have a coffee with him, she said yes. "Your friend looks angry, homicidally angry." Perry glanced behind her, saw Colette standing with Eric, still chanting and pumping her fist, but also, absurdly, glaring at the two of them. Perry swallowed back laughter. That would have wrought irreparable damage. She shrugged apologetically and walked away. They went to a small cafe and sat at a table by the window. He ordered them coffee and a crusted millefeuille each. Perry watched him speak to the waiter in a tone of genial authority that she recalled well and felt the same flutter in the gut that she had as a girl when he would come over to pick up Maman. She felt suddenly self-conscious of her bitten fingernails, her unpowdered face, her hair hanging in limp curls. She wished now that she'd dried it after the shower, but she'd been late and Colette had been pacing like a zoo animal. "I hadn't pegged you as the protesting type," Julian said, lighting her cigarette for her. "I'm not. That was more guilt than conviction."
"Guilt? Over seal hunting?"
"Over Colette. Oh, yes. You know, I think I may be a little frightened of her." "We all are." They laughed. He reached across the table and touched her scarf. He dropped his hand.
"It would be trite to say that you're all grown up, so I won't. But you do look ravishing, Perry."
She pinched the lapel of her raincoat.
"What, in this Clouseau outfit?"
Colette had told her it was a stupid habit, this self-deprecating, clowning around with which Perry tried to mask her nervousness around men she was attracted to, especially when they complimented her. Not for the first time, and far from the last, she envied Maman her naturally self-assured disposition. "Next you'll say I'm living up to my name," she said.
"Oh no, please, too obvious. There's an art to complimenting a woman, you know."
"No, but I'm certain you do." The waiter brought the pastries and coffee. Perry focused on the waiter's hands as he arranged the cups and plates on the table, the palms of her own hands blooming with sweat. She had had only 4 lovers in her lifetime, a modest number, she knew, certainly compared to Maman at her age, even Colette. She was too watchful, too sensible, too compromising and adaptable.
on the whole steadier and less exhausting than either Maman or Colette. But these were not qualities that drew men in droves, and she hadn't loved any of them, though she had lied to one and said she did. But pinned beneath each of them, she had thoughts of Julian, of him and his beautiful face, which seemed to come with its own private lighting. As they ate, he talked about his work. He said he had quit teaching some time ago. He had worked on debt sustainability at the IMF for a few years. The best part of that had been the traveling, he said. Where to? Jordan, Iraq. Then I took a couple of years to write a book on informal economies. Where you published? That is a rumor, he smiled. I work for a private counseling firm now, here in Paris. I want to travel too, Parry said. Colette keeps saying we should go to Afghanistan. I suspect I know why she would want to go. Well, I've been thinking about it. Going back there, I mean. I don't care about the hashish, but I do want to travel the country, see where I was born, maybe find the old house where my parents and I lived. I didn't realize you had this compulsion. I'm curious, I mean. I remember so little. I think one time you said something about a family cook. Parry was inwardly flattered that he recalled something she had told him so many years before. He must have thought of her then, in the intervening time. She must have been on his mind. Yes, his name was Nabi. He was the chauffeur, too. He drove my father's car. A big American car, blue with a tan top. I remember it had an eagle's head on the hood. Later, he asked, and she told him about her studies and her focus on complex variables. He listened in a way that Maman never did. Maman, who seemed bored by the subject and mystified by Paris' passion for it. Maman couldn't even feign interest. She made light-hearted jokes that on the surface appeared to poke fun at her own ignorance. "Ooh la la," she would say, grinning. My head, spinning like a totem. I'll make you a deal, Parry. I'll pour us some tea, and you return to the planet. D'accord? She would chuckle, and Parry would humor her. But she sensed an edge to these jokes. An oblique sort of chiding. A suggestion that her knowledge had been judged esoteric, and her pursuit of it frivolous. Frivolous. Which was rich, Parry thought, coming from a poet. Though she would never say so to her mother. Julianne asked what she saw in mathematics, and she said she found it comforting. I might have chosen daunting as a more fitting adjective, he said. It's that, too. She said there was comfort to be found in the permanence of mathematical truths, in the lack of arbitrariness and the absence of ambiguity, in knowing that the answers may be elusive, but they could be found. They were there, waiting, chuck scribbles away. Nothing like life, in other words, he said. There it's questions with either no answers or messy ones. Am I that transparent? She laughed and hid her face with a napkin. I sound like an idiot. Not at all, he said. He plucked away the napkin. Not at all. Like one of your students, I must remind you of your students. He asked more questions, through which Parry saw that he had a working knowledge of analytic number theory and was, at least, in passing, familiar with Carl Gauss and Bernhard Riemann. They spoke until the sky darkened. They drank coffee, and then beer, which led to wine. And then, when it could not be delayed any longer, Julian leaned in a bit and said it in a polite, dutiful tone. And tell me, how is Nila? Parry puffed her cheeks and let the air out slowly. Julian nodded knowingly. She may lose the bookstore, Parry said. I'm sorry to hear that. Business has been declining for years. She may have to shut it down. She wouldn't admit to it, but that would be a blow. It would hit her hard. Is she writing? She hasn't been. He soon changed the subject. Parry was relieved. She didn't want to talk about Maman and her drinking and the struggle to get her to keep taking her pills. Parry remembered all the awkward gazes, all the times when they were alone, She and Julien. Maman getting dressed in the next room. Julien looking at Parry and her trying to think of something to say. Maman must have sensed it. Could it be the reason she had ended it with Julien? If so, Parry had an inkling. She had done so more as a jealous lover than a protective mother. A few weeks later, Julien asked Parry to move in with him. He lived in a small apartment on the left bank in the 7th arrondissement. Parry said yes. Colette's prickly hostility made for an untenable atmosphere at the apartment now. Parry remembers her first Sunday with Julien at his place. They were reclined on his couch, pressed against each other. Parry was pleasantly half awake, and Julien was drinking tea, his long legs resting on the coffee table. He was reading an opinion piece on the back page of the newspaper. Jacques Brel played on the turntable. Every now and then, Parry would shift her head on his chest, and Julien would lean down and place a small kiss on her eyelid, or her ear, or her nose. "We have to tell Maman." She could feel him tightening. He folded the paper, removed his reading glasses, and put them on the arm of the couch. "She needs to know." "I suppose," he said.
"You suppose?"
"No, of course, you're right. You should call her. But be careful. Don't ask for permission or blessing. You'll get neither. Just tell her, and make sure she knows this is not a negotiation." "That's easy for you to say." "Well, perhaps. Still, remember that Nila is a vindictive woman. I am sorry to say this, but this is why it ended with us. She's astonishingly vindictive. So I know it won't be easy for you." Parry sighed and closed her eyes. The thought of it made her stomach clench. Julien stroked her back with his palm. "Don't be squeamish." Parry called her the next day. Maman already knew.
"Who told you?"
"Colette." "Of course," Parry thought. "I was going to tell you." "I know you were. You are. It can't be hidden. A thing like this."
"Are you angry?"
"Does it matter?" Parry was standing by the window. With her finger, she absently traced the blue rim of Julien's old, battered ashtray. She shut her eyes.
"No, Maman, it doesn't."
"Well, I wish I could say that didn't hurt."
"I didn't mean it to."
"I think that's highly debatable."
"Why would I want to hurt you, Maman?"
Maman laughed, a hollow, ugly sound. "I look at you sometimes, and I don't see me in you. Of course I don't. I suppose that isn't unexpected after all. I don't know what sort of person you are, Parry. I don't know who you are, what you are capable of in your blood. You're a stranger to me."
"I don't understand what that means," Parry said.
But her mother had already hung up. From Afghan Songbird, An Interview with Nila Vahdati, by Etienne Boustolet. Parallax 84, Winter 1974, page 38. "Did you learn your French here?"
"My mother taught me in Kabul when I was little. She spoke only French to me. We had lessons every day. It was very hard on me when she left Kabul."
"For France?"
"Yes. My parents divorced in 1939, when I was 10. I was my father's only child. Letting me go with her was out of the question. So I stayed. And she left for Paris to live with her sister, Agnès. My father tried to mitigate the loss for me by occupying me with a private tutor and writing lessons and art lessons. But nothing replaces a mother."
"What happened to her?"
"Oh, she died. When the Nazis came to Paris. They didn't kill her, they killed Agnès. My mother, she died of pneumonia. My father didn't tell me until the Allies had liberated Paris. But by then, I already knew. I just knew."
"That must have been difficult."
"It was devastating. I loved my mother. I had planned on living with her in France after the war."
"I assume that means your father and you didn't get along."
"There were strains between us. We were quarreling quite a lot, which was a novelty for him.
He wasn't accustomed to being talked back to, certainly not by women. We had rows over what I wore, where I went, what I said, how I said it, who I said it to. I had